One of the elements of culture that really has a large impact in the church is the difference between Eastern culture and Western culture and the backgrounds that they play in our lives. Now, you might think that that wouldn't be a big element in most churches in the United States or elsewhere around the world, unless you have a lot of immigrants, but that would not be true. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's get to it. Welcome to the All Things to All People podcast. I am Michael Burns. We're continuing to go through the book All Things to All People, and we are moving into chapter 12 today, which is simply entitled East and West. And we're going to talk about that dynamic of Eastern culture and Western culture that can pop up even in a church that you wouldn't seem to, that doesn't have a lot of, you know, immigrants or travelers or whatever, that there's really these two strong, broad elements of culture that we see played out often in churches. And it's my pleasure today. We have an amazing guest today. His name is Gilbert Kemeng. Gilbert is a really good friend of mine. He's a disciple of Jesus Christ, and he is a teacher of God's Word in Lagos, Nigeria. Gilbert is an amazing guy. We'll tell you more about him in a bit. But Gilbert, welcome to the All Things to All People podcast.
Michael, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Amen. And we have prayed, and now we are living in hope that the connection will hold strong and well between here and you're currently in Lagos.
I am in Lagos, Nigeria.
Yes. Wish that we could be in the same room, but we will have to settle for this. I'm really looking forward to our audience getting to hear from you and getting to know you. And I definitely want to talk to you in a little bit here. Let me read a little bit from chapter 12, and then we'll do some chatting, okay?
Wonderful.
All right, chapter 12, East and West. One of my favorite movie scenes comes early in the original Jurassic Park, where Dr. Ian Malcolm tries to explain chaos theory to Dr. Sattler as they wind their way through the park in a driverless car. Malcolm illustrates his point by dripping water on Dr. Sattler's hand twice and noting that each time the drop of water runs down her hand on a different path. What Dr. Malcolm then explains in simple terms is the chaos theory that states that apparent randomness within systems is the result of underlying patterns that are often unseen. Tiny differences in conditions that are unnoticeable to the casual observer can result in widely different outcomes. If you've ever watched American game shows on television, think of the Plinko game on The Price is Right. You can drop your chip from the same spot at the top, but watch it land in different slots at the bottom. It can be the difference between winning $10,000 or nothing. Well, it looks like you're dropping from the same exact spot. The slightest change in hand position, angle of release, and many other factors can result in wildly different endings. The principles of chaos theory can apply to people in many situations. Why does the same action of church discipline wind up with different results when applied to different people, for example? It might seem random, but there are many small factors that have an impact. Two young men both fall prey to sexual immorality before marriage on multiple occasions. They both fail to take advantage of the help offered them, spurn advice, and repeatedly fall into sin. As the biblically prescribed steps of church discipline are followed, the time comes when both are removed from the community in an effort to shock them into repentance. One brother is immediately stung by the action and brought to his senses. He humbles himself to the biblical standard and works hard with the brother who is provided as a spiritual support to help gently restore him to God and to the community. The other young man thinks about it for a time and then decides he doesn't need that church anyway. He just moves on and finds another church more to his liking. The same action has been employed, but with opposite results. There are countless variables in situations like these that could lead to different results. But in these two cases, which are true stories, I've always suspected that cultural conditioning played a big part. The prescription of removing someone who refuses to be helped by the community in order to change their behavior to bring it in line with King Jesus comes from a biblical culture that was fundamentally Eastern. It was rooted in honor and shame, community-first cultures rather than Western cultures that operate on a guilt and innocence basis and foster individuality. The brother who returned to the church community was from an African country. He had been brought up with the honor and shame ethic, which dictates that the primary determiner of right and wrong is in the eyes of the community. The other brother hails from the Midwest in the United States and was reared in the Western guilt and innocence culture, where right and wrong are established by standards and laws, and the community works to instill these sensibilities into the individual so that they're guided by those standards internally and with no concern as to what others think. There are strengths and weaknesses to both cultural types. The African brother was stunned deeply by the loss of community and what he viewed as being shamed in their eyes. Since the community determines right and wrong, they spoke loudly and he was driven to change. The American brother was brought up in a society that didn't see sexual trysts as much of a problem. As long as there are two consenting adults, all is good. He was also taught that the individual has the right to get what they need and want, as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. Even though he was baptized into Christ and wanted to be a disciple, he never truly challenged those core cultural beliefs. And when he was told that he was wrong for having sex outside of marriage, he never really embraced that value. When he was disciplined by the community, he didn't care that much. His internal monitor told him that his actions were okay, and his cultural training had taught him that what others thought really didn't matter. He would just go find another community with no sense of guilt following him because in his eyes, he had done nothing that was truly wrong. He had a sin issue, but his culture played into it and made the situation worse. That's the power of culture. It can even condition us toward a standard of right and wrong. In general terms, Western cultures believe that the law or the rules determine right and wrong, and what others might think is not a major factor. Eastern cultures tend toward the community being the judge of what is shameful and what is not. And if the community does not judge the action as an offense, then there's no guilt. Sociologists label this Western style of culture as guilt and innocence cultures, or what I will refer to from now on as guilt cultures. Eastern cultures are typically honor and shame-based. These two broad cultures, guilt-based and shame-based, are both widespread, and with increased global immigration and mobility, they often interact and clash with one another around the world. We will summarize the broad characteristics of these two worldviews in this chapter. It's important to understand some of the basic values and life approaches of these two cultures. Because of a diverse church, it is likely that there are people bearing characteristics of each group. There's a third cultural type separate from Eastern and Western cultures. These groups tend to come from tribal and island locations that have been more isolated in the past. We'll refer to these as fear cultures and we'll only briefly discuss them at the end of the chapter. You may well have members of your group with roots in one of these fear cultures, but they're far less prevalent than the two to which we will give most of our attention. Let's stop there, Gilbert, and let everyone get to know you a little bit. As I mentioned, you're a teacher in the church in Lagos. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, and the church there in Lagos. Give us a little update.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael, for having me. Real joy, real honor to just join in this conversation around culture. And so introduce myself. I would like to mention how culture has played out also in my upbringing. I was born in Cameroon, a neighboring country to Nigeria. My mom is originally from Nigeria, but she actually spent most of her life in Cameroon. Of course, got married to my father in Cameroon. I was born there. Cameroon happens to be like the reverse of Canada. Canada has French and English, Cameroon too. But Canada happens to be majority English and minority French speaking. Cameroon is the exact opposite. So majority French speaking and minority English speaking. So I was born in the English speaking part of Cameroon, but ended up going to university in the French speaking part before leaving Cameroon for Germany as a scholarship student to study engineering. Arrived Germany in 1990, just when the Berlin Wall came down around that period. So there was a lot going on in Europe at the time in Germany. Became a disciple in 1992. Some very challenging circumstances. I survived cancer, and I was reached out to by one of the doctors who was treating me in hospital. So I spent 4 years in Germany, two of those years as a disciple. And so got really integrated into the German culture, especially through the church. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I taught the Berlin church via Zoom, and I was still speaking in German. Mm-hmm. So that's how, German I became, that many, many years later, I'm still speaking the language. And then moved to Abidjan to join a missions team that was going to go plant the church in Cameroon. So they ended up spending 10 years in Abidjan serving in French-speaking Africa, and I was between Abidjan and Cameroon. So long story short, I have this mixture of three cultures from a language perspective. The Cameroon English part of me, and then the German me becoming a disciple at a very critical time of my life, survived cancer while being a student there, and then spent a lot of years serving in French-speaking Africa. So I have this mixture. My mom at home calls me the Francophone, even though I'm from the English-speaking part of Cameroon. And then when I'm here, so people call me different names depending on where I am. When I'm in Abidjan, I'm the Anglophone. So just an interesting mixture.
That's incredible. And Gilbert, how many languages do you actually speak?
Well, actually, officially, I mean, the international languages are the three I mentioned, English, French, and German. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, I speak the African language. My father is from the northwestern part of Cameroon. So there's a you came very close to my village where we met 3 years ago in Cameroon, just an hour away from Bamenda.
Okay.
And so I speak the Bikom language, which is from the northwestern part of Cameroon. I grew up speaking that. We speak that at home. And of course, you have the broken English, which is like they call it Pidgin English. That's like the street language that you use when you go to the market, where you use locally. Nigeria has a version of that. So those are like the major languages. And of course, I've been trying to learn some Spanish, which is pretty close to French.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you've had a busy kind of home life here recently with a new addition. Why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah, very true. So we got married. I had a very interesting life as a single man, especially with all the missionary travels from Germany to Côte d'Ivoire to Cameroon. It took a long time for me to settle down. So I finally settled down after being a disciple for 20 years in the church. That was 2012 that I got married to my beautiful wife, Perita. She's from here. And then some background, I mentioned surviving cancer. So 2 years into our marriage, we found out that because of my treatment, chemotherapy, and all of that, it did affect me in terms of fertility. So we actually were married for 7 years without a child. And then God blessed us incredibly through adoption. We adopted a handsome boy. His name is Joseph. He was 2 months old. He's now 20 months old, and he's kept our family very vibrant, just full of life, full of joy. That has really, really changed my life and our marriage in a very, very positive way in the past, 18 months since he was adopted. Yeah.
Hey, man, that's happy for you guys. That's incredible. I know how proud you are of him and your wife, who's an amazing woman as well. Appreciate you taking time away from them to be on the podcast with us here. And just for my listeners here, Gilbert, his home church is in Lagos, which is a rather large congregation. About how many members do you have in the Lagos Church of Christ right now?
I would say approximately we are 2,000 at the moment.
About 2,000.
Yeah.
So
yeah, about 2,000.
That
exactly.
That keeps you busy with the other teachers there in Lagos, Emmanuel, Emma, and Fred.
Emmanuel
George.
And Fred.
Yeah, and you kind of have the unique position of Gilbert travels around and teaches quite a bit, not only because of his ability and skill as a biblical teacher, but also the added bonus of being able to speak in French and speak in some of these other languages. Gilbert travels a lot. Nigeria is primarily English speaking, but Gilbert can go into the Côte d'Ivoire and into so many of the French countries and teach in places where it's very difficult. I've been to some of those countries, Gilbert, and I think I'm about as half as effective because I have to spend half of my time standing there and having what I just said translated. And you can have the amazing ability to speak directly as you teach. And so I'm grateful for that. And we've had the opportunity to work and teach together in a number of countries. At one point, we'd kind of made an informal list. I don't remember exactly now, but I know we've we've been together in Nigeria, in Cameroon, in
Ghana.
Were we in Ivory
Kenya.
Coast together? Kenya?
Ivory Coast.
Ivory
correct.
Coast, the correct. United States, maybe even correct. South Africa. Have we been there at the same time or did we?
No, we missed each other narrowly, I think.
Missed each other there. So we'll have to have a meeting there or something. But
I remember when we met in Kenya, we kind of did an update of the places we've been and taught together.
That's right.
And your parting words to me when you were leaving for the airport, that was last year, you were like, we got to find out the seventh country
that's
where
right.
we're going to teach together.
That's right. Well, and
I remember that.
And who knew? Who knew the situation that would develop this year? Hopefully, Africa will the African countries will open up their borders to United States travelers once again, or vice versa. It's mostly shut down right now. We actually had to cancel a trip over there in August. And hoping that
I can imagine,
yeah, hoping that we can get back over there again sometime. But Gilbert, you are, as you gave your background, I think the audience started to get a feel for, you're the perfect mix in a lot of ways of, this cultural, milieu and understanding. And you've, I think spent some time in a more Eastern collective, honor shame type culture, and then you've spent some time
correct.
in Germany is almost the prototype of Western individualist culture in some ways.
Very true.
So what has been kind of your experience with that, just on the surface? What can help us to understand the difference between these two cultural groups?
It's amazing, Michael, just even going through the chapter with you as you read through. And of course, I've had the opportunity to read your work. And it's amazing how I read stuff like what you were just reading now. And it just resonates in an amazing way. So I'll probably just start on the surface by saying that even in my person, just like you rightly said, I spent a majority of my time, of course, in the Eastern, culture, honor, shame based. But it's been interesting for me to realize over the years when after spending some years in Germany and I had to come back to Africa for mission work, it was quite interesting to come back to Africa to now realize the clash of these two culture types in me as a person. And so I'll give some very quick examples. For example, in our environment here, some friends would tend to call me the German because they know that I have a tendency. I mean, maybe for a German, they might not feel exactly that way. But in this environment here, they will call me a German in terms of referring to my love for maybe keeping to time, or can we plan this in advance? Let me put this on my schedule. if you're trying to reach out to me for us to plan a teaching session, I will appreciate it if you let me know 2 weeks in advance so I have enough time to prepare. So in our environment here, and in Africa, we kind of privilege relationships to time management. And so when I come across like somebody who's really, taking time management seriously or into consideration, then I get the call for some of my good friends. They now call me at that time the German. And so, of course, like you said, German society, even having lived not only in Germany, but traveled around Europe, and of course, being in the U.S., the Germans, they might, when it comes to timekeeping, they might be taking it to a really higher standard, even within the Western culture.
Yeah.
So some of that definitely rubbed off my character. And so I really liked one of those lines when you were reading, where you just acknowledge the fact that both these cultures have their strengths and their weaknesses. And so I tend to see in me, in my personality, times when I swing from one to the other and trying to maximize the strengths of each of those cultures. So those are a few thoughts I just wanted to mention upfront. Mm.
So in your experience, the various African cultures that you have lived in, is it fair to say that they tend to be more honor shame, the Eastern type of cultural approach?
It's more than fair to say that. It's amazing how true that is, because in talking about what I was trying to express earlier, is each time the Western side of me, where I'm coming more from an individualistic perspective, or working more from a personal conscience perspective, very often when I come across that way, maybe in a conversation or in a decision-making setting, while in the African context, I sound like a foreigner, because a lot of the thinking is what is good for the collective, what is good for the group. As you likely spelled out, there are strengths and weaknesses of both cultures. But I'll say across Africa, having lived in Côte d'Ivoire, for example, there's an incredible sense of solidarity, be it when there are funerals, when somebody loses a close one, in the West, or be it weddings, for example. A lot of those things in the Western world tends to be handled in a very more of a private way, or really close circle of friends. But of course, in Africa, your cousin is your brother or your sister, your uncle is your father. So it's the collective. So the saying that it takes a village to raise a child is so true in the African setting.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think what's, you know, for this podcast, obviously we're based in the United States and a lot of the listeners are American, although certainly not all. And I'm very pleased with that about a quarter of our audience, and sometimes even more, is from elsewhere around the world. And and maybe that's more now. I haven't checked those stats for a while. I'll have to look. But in the U.S., there's, you know, a really high degree of mix between Eastern and Western culture. And you know, especially, you know, a lot of, you know, African-Americans, Asian-Americans are, you know, tend to be more Eastern-based, and then the European-Americans tend to be more Western. Let me read this next section, because I want to kind of get your thoughts on each one of these areas of the difference between East and West and the dynamics that it can play, you know, whether you're within a church and you have people with different cultural backgrounds, or, you know, sometimes even between churches. I know I've seen that dynamic play out when an American church and an African church are working together, that sometimes cultural things and expectations and assumptions can come into play.
But that is true.
Yeah. Let me read this part real quick, and then I want to go through this list and get your input. It says, there's been so much overlap and mixing of cultures, especially in my country, the United States, that it's rare to find someone who completely meets all the norms when it comes to identifying whether you or someone else falls within the boundaries of a Western guilt or Eastern shame culture. For most people, it's a matter of degree, but it's also true that most people lean toward one or the other. As I look at some of the markers, it becomes clear that I have been rooted firmly in a Western cultural worldview. My wife is an interesting case. She's lived in the Western culture of America her entire life, and her family has been rooted here for centuries, yet they have maintained many of the characteristics and values that would be more closely identified with the Eastern-style cultures of Africa from where her ancestors came long ago. She's been influenced by Western culture, but still carries many Eastern features. So here are a few questions that will help distinguish between classic Western and Eastern instincts. So I'm going to read each one of these, Gilbert, and if you just have a comment on how that particular aspect can play out, please jump in. So number one.
Definitely.
Number one, is the best way to train for a job to A, get a formal education, or B, apprentice to and observe someone? Any thoughts or comments
on
that?
Quickly on that.
Yeah, please.
Yes, definitely. I mean, when I read this, it really resonated with me, because I'll take the Nigerian landscape, economic job environment as an example. It is so often the case in Nigeria that a lot of people don't end up working in an industry or in a field that is directly related with whatever they studied in school or university.
Hmm.
So that's a typical case where the answer to this question will be a big B, where the best way to train for a job is a lot more of the apprentice and the observing of someone. So you go to school and get a certificate. Most of the time in this environment, what that certificate or degree, whatever it is, it kind of opens the door for you to go for a particular interview, so that they're checking through your CV to look at your qualifications. But once you show up for that interview, and I've experienced it personally, after being in the church, working the church staff for 13 years, I did go back to school and earned a degree in communication, public relations. And then I went job hunting, and I had exactly this experience where, in fact, after getting the entry for the interview, what was really important when I got the interview was now the different life experiences I've had, the skills I developed. So long story short, in that environment here, it will be a big, the answer will be a B, apprentice and observing someone, learning, developing those skills.
And of course, in the Western culture, the normal answer would be more A. So you have a very sharp difference there. Let's look at number two. Are illnesses best initially treated by A, a doctor, or B, a traditional family remedy?
Oh, man, I can't stop but say something about that.
Yeah, no, please.
So, yeah, again, in our environment, I remember having, I think last week I did give a talk to the Houston church at midweek, and they wanted to hear about what's happening here. Mm-hmm. With COVID-19 and all of that. And so when I was sharing about even the medical situation here is, I mean, you rarely find things like, and just the support, medical support. So what happens often here is that a lot of people do what you call self-medication. Mm. And so... it takes a few educated people to maybe when you're feeling, when you have like fever, which malaria is a common thing in our environment, the tropical environment. So it'll be interesting to do a research of how many people, when they feel feverish, which is one of the big symptoms of malaria, I'll say very few people will go to the hospital to do a test and establish if it's malaria. Typhoid fever often feels like malaria. So I was treating malaria, but in the long run, because...
Unfortunately, it sounds like the signal... between here and Nigeria is weakened a little bit. We're going to hopefully... Do we have you back, Gilbert?
Michael.
Sorry about that, everybody. This is part of the fun.
Hello?
Yes. Do we have you, Gilbert?
Okay, cool. So let me just make sure I recap what I was trying to explain.
Please,
so
go ahead.
What I was just basically trying to say is most people will first try. That people use to treat malaria, they'll try that out first before, if it's only when things get really bad that they tend to want to go through the into a test. Yeah, going to be here.
Amen. Thanks for sharing that. Let me read on a little more. I'll read a couple here. When you do something wrong, you're most bothered by A, your internal conscience, or B, the disapproval of the community around you. Number four is, should inappropriate behavior be remedied by formal law and punishment? That's A. Or B, informal tradition and consensus of the community. Five is the key to starting a new business or getting a good job to A, have a good business plan or strategy, or B, know the right people and have the right contacts. Six, should the possessions of a deceased family member be A, distributed by formal will, or B, passed on by a family leader? Seven, do you think of family members or over 70 as A, an obligation and needed care must be arranged for them, or B, someone to be respected and revered, and caring for them when needed is an honor and sacred duty. Let me pause here, Gilbert, and say, you were talking about the tendency to want to do more home remedies and go to the doctor. It's kind of a joke in our family. We've definitely experienced that. My wife, our kind of household joke is she wants to put witch hazel on everything. There's this astringent called witch hazel, and she's like, I'm like, let me guess, he's got a broken ankle, should we put witch hazel on it? And that just kind of comes from her family thing. But let me back up quickly, and I want to ask you about number three. Which says when you do something wrong, you're bothered by either your internal conscience or more the disapproval of the community around you. Do you have anything you can add on that? Is that an element you see where you're at? Is that the disapproval of the community is a stronger pull than the actual right or wrong of the behavior inherently in itself?
Absolutely. You're totally right. So I'll probably just want to share one or two anecdotes or examples to back that up. In our environment, it's definitely the disapproval of the community. I really like the example earlier on of the two, guys who had some sexual challenges before they got married and how the African guy turned around. That typically plays out here in our environment, in the church, in the church culture, that even when people leave, coming back, the big part of their coming back is what will people say? They're going to have to overcome people's opinions, what people will say. So you find a lot of people who maybe their conscience is really pushing them to want to come back like the prodigal son, but the biggest part of their restoration to the community and ultimately to God is going to be overcoming, you know, the disapproval of the community, how they were treated or what people said about them. Even when they come back, it takes them a while to just overcome a lot of that. So that's really rooted in the honor and shame culture. And a quick one, which I experienced recently, was, you know, I was in the U.S. Early March for the teachers conference. Mm-hmm. And we met there shortly. And I had to rush back home. I had to cut short my trip and rush back home because of the COVID-19. In fact, I got back home and the travel ban in Nigeria took effect like a few hours after that. I got back here in the afternoon and it took effect by midnight the next day. No flights could come in.
Wow.
So I was quarantined. Of course, I first had to do the first 14 days. And then there was a lockdown announced by the Lagos state government, which prolonged my quarantine. And during this time, my family had to go stay with my in-laws. So I was alone at home without my family. It had its challenges. It was like a retreat on one end. But it was quite interesting because for me to have my family come back home, I was insisting that I really like to get tested because I don't want to endanger my family. So this was my internal conscience playing out. But then I had a lot of trials to do that. I even talked to a medical person. They were very close to coming home, coming to my place to come and do the test. But they said they had very little resources. And so I just had a phone interview given me by the doctor on the phone. And he said, look, I believe you're fine. You're okay. We're focusing on those who have obvious symptoms and all of that. So I think you can have your family come back. But while I was staying on to want to really do the test, I had a lot of pressure from the community to say, look, your family needs to come back home. So I found myself in a conflict between my internal conscience and the general opinion of the community, even the church, the doctor himself. And that was a very typical example of me holding on to my conscience and the community saying, look, I think you're fine. They need to come back home. So long story short, I spent 30 days alone before my family came back.
Wow. That's a great example of that culture clash there within your own experience.
Correct.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Let me knock out a few more
of these.
Number 8. Does the definition of family include A, parents, spouse, and children, or B, a large network of all extended relations? I don't even have to ask you that one, Gilbert. You've already kind of alluded to it. That's definitely been the clash between my wife and I, is these differing views. And I know in just me being over in Africa a lot, the extended family and the obligations of the extended family are incredibly important. And that plays in a lot of cultures here, even in the United States, where people have maintained that perspective.
Correct.
Yeah. Let me read on the last four here, and then if you have any thoughts you want to share, please jump in. Number nine, should family events begin A, on time, or B, once the key people have arrived? I'll just say, having experienced that one in the African cultures, I'm going to go with B on that one.
And big one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Whereas, you know, I grew up, it's definitely A, you start on time and let's roll. It doesn't, if you're not here, you're not here. And my wife and I have definitely, and I've seen that play out in the church where, you know, people have the different cultural views that inform that. Number 10, when you have money, should you primarily A, save and invest it, or B, foster relationships, help family members in need, and spend it on needs and wants while you have it? you know, there's a cultural element there, Gilbert, where I've had people come and feel this pressure of like, hey, culturally, I should be taking care of family and I have to do it so much. There's so many requests that I don't even have money left to support the church or, you know, that kind of thing. And so it becomes really, you know, an issue there. Last two, do you deeply desire A, equality and fairness in life, or to be well thought of and respected by those in your community? And number 12, at a meeting, should the person with the most influence be A, the person with the best job, or B, the oldest or most respected person in the room?
That's an interesting one, actually.
Yeah, any response to any of
those? I'd like to comment on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so starting with the last one, it's quite an interesting one because right here in Nigeria, there is a tribe, and I mean, Africans or friends listening to us who have Nigerian friends, you know, of the Igbo tribe, for example.
Yes.
So the Igbo tribe is one of the largest ethnic groups, along with the Yoruba and the Hausas in Nigeria. And there are lots of many others, but those are like the big ones. The Hausas being towards the north of Nigeria. So the Igbos, it's quite interesting because in the Igbo culture, it will be an A. I will say it's an A in the Igbo culture because in the Igbo culture, they are known to be very business savvy in terms of their own businesses. They do a lot of, they're just simply business when it comes to business. They just have that. They sometimes call themselves the Jews, the African Jews. Quite interesting stuff there. But in that culture, you might actually be the youngest of a family with five or six siblings. But if you're the one with the most money, you're the one who is respected the most. So that's kind of like an exception, and almost the opposite of maybe a Yoruba culture where age is a big factor. So the Yoruba culture respects elderly people. You've been here. When I moved to Nigeria initially, I almost struggled in the beginning. It felt like we had to worship human beings. The way when you see an elderly person, the way you have to bow, you know, and all of that. And of course, I've lived here long enough to understand that and to be part of the culture now. But I found that quite interesting that within the African culture, you could have a bit of those differences. But if I had to answer for the majority, it would be a B.
That's good. And is it Yoruba, Gilbert, where not just expected to bow to an older person, but actually get prostrate? Is that right?
That is the word I was avoiding, but you've taken me there.
Yeah.
So that's where I struggled initially. I was like, this feels like worship, man.
Yeah, you get down on your face.
It's even more intense because I'm sure you know Konito, who was a brother from Congo.
Yeah.
And he got married to a sister who's from here, Yoruba. I mean, at the traditional wedding, he had to lie down flat on his stomach.
Oh.
So this is real prostrate, fully flat on the stomach. That's
right.
Part of the ritual, you know, exactly.
Wow, what a challenge. Let me finish up this section. And then I have a
challenge.
Let me finish this up, and then I have a specific question I want to ask you as we close out this episode.
Sure.
Just wrap up this section. It says, any A responses would align you with the typical values of a Western-based culture, while the B responses would correlate more with an Eastern approach. As I stated, I would answer A for the majority of these questions and others like them, while my wife would answer B for many of them. Just take a moment to go back through the list and imagine how that works in a single household. You can imagine that we've had numerous misunderstandings and differences of opinion over the years. Now extrapolate those challenges to a large church body, and you can begin to imagine the chasms that can easily exist in expectations and assumptions that the people bring with them into community. So, Gilbert, here's my question, and I want to pivot just a little bit here at the end, and my apologies, because I'm going to ask you a question that that we've not talked about or you prepped. So this is coming out of the blue, but as you know, the last couple weeks, the United States has been very much impacted by a deep cultural shift that is happening that has really been brewing for a long time. In one sense, you could say years. In another sense, you could say decades. In another sense, you could say centuries. But the, George Floyd was a man in my community here in Minneapolis, and was, as I think I'm sure everybody at this point knows, was very unjustly killed while in police custody. And that set off a series of protests around the country, and things have really, public opinion has shifted in a way that's been surprising in some respects and very encouraging in others. But I wanted to ask you, from your perspective in Nigeria, you've been to the United States a couple of times. What are your thoughts and your perspective on what you know of what's going on here and the race relations in general? And I'll just leave it at that and throw it over to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to start, Michael, thanks for asking that, because I know, I was like, that'll probably come up somewhere during the podcast, because number one, I just wanted to start by saying we're totally with you guys, and to even know that it happened right there in Minneapolis. I was there last year.
That's right.
March last year. So just want to express how much our hearts are out there with you guys, with all that you're going through, the pain, the trauma. We've been watching it through television. I remember yesterday, my wife was on BBC, I was on CNN. We're almost like comparing notes. She's telling me what she saw on BBC. I was telling her what I saw on CNN and all that stuff. So just trying to share how much we're really sharing in what you guys are going through right now. Talking about race in general and my take. Like I mentioned to you earlier, living in Germany for me was the height of me having to deal with the racial differences. I experienced that to an extent within Cameroon, which was more of a language divide between French and English speaking Cameroon. So Africa would talk, in Africa, we have more of the tribal equivalent of what you guys are experiencing as racial challenges. In Africa, it's more of tribalism, but also division that might come from languages in the case of Cameroon. But living in Germany for me was a big one. Where, of course, Germany with the past and issues with Nazi Germany and racism. So I often get people asking me questions around, Gilbert, I mean, you lived in Germany. What's your take? Are Germans racist? And so I have this general statement I make to kind of distinguish what I see when it comes to racism, was that my experience in Germany gave me quite some insight. I'll mention two things quickly. So, and then probably share how that might apply to what you guys are going through. So in Germany, I noticed that there were two groups of Germans in general. Those who had traveled out of Germany to other countries, or maybe to Africa, to the US. A lot of Germans actually have been to the US and they travel around Europe and all of that. I noticed that a lot of those Germans were very, number one, very open-minded and were very welcoming towards foreigners. And my understanding of that was that having been out there, not only were had they expanded their horizons, they had interacted with other cultures, and they had probably experienced a lot of warmth and hospitality from other cultures. So they're basically a lot more culturally humble and culturally intelligent, if you want to use those two expressions to describe them. Unlike those who had not had the opportunity to travel out, who tended to be more narrow-minded. And I'll mention this very quickly, which I probably mentioned in a video I did earlier last week, is that a brother in the church told me once, a German brother, he's a mixture of German and Italian with dark hair. He confessed to me once that it is through me and through our friendship that he has come to realize that all human beings are the same. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was very revealing, because he was basically confessing a lot of prejudice that he had grown up with that had come out of his maybe education, schooling, what he watched on the TV, I don't know, parenting. So a combination of his upbringing had developed that stereotype about Black people, about Africans. But I think the longer he interacted with me and we being together in the church, he came to a realization probably that this guy is just like me. There's no difference. And so that's where his confession came from. And so I'm just sharing this from my experience, not having lived in the U.S., but watching from a distance, I would say there's a lot of education that needs to be done where on both ends, but especially in the situation now towards people of color in the U.S., there's a huge responsibility on the side of the Caucasian, the white Americans or people in that culture to just really dig up and educate themselves about the history of Africans, of the Black Americans. And then on the other side, I remember I used to challenge my African friends in Germany that, look, you guys come here to Germany and you sit in your clusters, you only interact with each other, and you're accusing Germans of being racist. I think you guys are being racist equally by not integrating yourselves with the Germans. So it's a job that has to be done on both sides of the aisle. Those are my few thoughts.
Gilbert, I appreciate your perspective. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. Thanks for joining us here today on the All Things to All People podcast. Please give my love to your wife and son and to Emmanuel and Fred and Chris and just all the brothers and sisters there in Lagos. We're so grateful to have you on today.
Michael, it's been my honor, and thanks for your friendship. And once more, just wish you guys a lot of strength as you were praying with you guys as you walk through the journey with what's going on over there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. We greatly appreciate it. That brings the episode to a close here. This is episode 18 as we talk about this gap in East and West. And we're going to finish the chapter out. We're going to have Gilbert back on in the next episode. Provided that the global internet continues to hold out, which we had a little hiccup today, but overall it was not too bad. So Once again, thanks to my guest, Gilbert Kemeng from Lagos, Nigeria. And we'll see you next time on the All Things to All People podcast.